Welcome to Make It Make Sense. We are Marlene and Paulina, two research assistants at the Obama Institute for Transnational American Studies at JGU Mainz.
In this podcast, we take you on a deep dive into the world of our study program. Together with guests from all throughout the discipline, we talk about everyday societal topics you might not have guessed are connected to our field.
Join us in making sense of the issues that surround us, and most importantly, have fun listening.
Welcome back to the final episode of season two of Make It Make Sense.
Okay, be honest, how crazy was it to just say that out loud?
It's a little surreal. It's freaking insane.
Yeah, I bet. And yet, here we are once again, bringing the season to a close and just having all the emotions.
But first, we need to, you know...
get it together.
We need to get it together.
You want me to leave and get a room or something?
Yeah, please. This is...
Actually.
All right. No, let's get topical for a second.
Yeah. And we're going to do that with an amazing guest who you've already heard now.
Spoiler.
Sorry.
Because we listened to y'all's request. We got the DMs. We answered your prayers. And here she is
once more.
Exactly. Julia Felten.
Hi. Thanks for having me again. And I'm not sure exactly who prayed, but thanks for
we did.
Having
She's
me again.
So excited to be back, you
guys. it's quite literally insane.
Yeah, no.
And since we already know you from last season, we're going to keep this introduction relatively short and try something new.
Right, because you're actually our first returning guest on the show. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And last time you were on the podcast, you were working on climate change fiction, right? So we would like to know from you right now, what has changed most in your research since then?
Or just
your thinking, yeah.
I think my thinking hasn't changed that much. I have had the honor to, I've been invited to give a lecture series in Dijon, where I talked about my project and climate change fiction and climate change in the United States and climate change in American studies. And that helped me to kind of structure my thoughts. And now I have like a rough outline and an idea of what I want to do in my book project. And now all I have to do is a lot of reading and a lot of writing, and then I'll be done.
Well, that sounds great and not hard at all.
Not at all.
And being that busy, thank you for coming back. And especially with the 250-year task force, where amazing stuff is happening right now.
Yes.
Could you talk a little about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're planning an exhibition of student projects. You listeners who are here at JGU Mainz can join in, by the way. There will be an info meeting on July 6th, which you can find all the information about on our website and on our Instagram account. So check that out. So if you want to join the fun and contribute a project to our exhibition, you're welcome to do so. And the exhibition is supposed to deal with the meaning of 250 years of the Declaration of Independence. And democracy in the United States, but we also have many, many more exciting talks, guests, lectures going on, and also had a great student conference on the topic. And there will be a publication on that organized by Paulina and others at the Institute. So there are quite a few events happening on that topic. And I'm very excited that this is happening and that we kind of critically think about what this anniversary means to American studies.
Such a huge number and such huge implications that come with it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. We're excited too. I'm excited. and with that, we're going straight into our topic for today, because we have brought you guys quite the agenda, because we're kind of picking up where we left off with you, Julia, right?
Right. So last time we talked about climate change narratives, and related to that, kind of brushed over the topic of science communication. And today we want to right that wrong and give the topic the attention it deserves.
Because science communication actually is something that is particularly important to us here in Mainz.
But since you listeners might be sick and tired of us always and rightfully praising Mainz and the OI, we're going to outsource that fun today.
Exactly. we brought you onto the show to talk about this exact topic. So, Julia, tell us why we care here in Mainz.
Well, I'm not sure my answer is going to address Mainz specifically, so you have to sing the praises for Mainz yourselves again.
We will.
Since we do that so well.
Exactly. You're the experts on that. I'm just here for the science communication. No, but I think it's important. It's important for everyone and every branch of university life, every branch of research to kind of get out of this ivory tower and provide knowledge to a broader public. For us in the American Studies Department here in Mainz, it's of course important because we do such great and amazing research, right?
So well done.
Thank you. And it's connected to American Studies or our research in so many ways, right? So one, we can view science communication as a field of research that we can think about how does science communication work? How can we as American Studies scholars kind of contribute to make the world a better place by helping mm-hmm. understand science communication better and kind of bridge that gap between natural sciences and a broader public, kind of be mediators in that sense. Mm-hmm. By also contributing our research. Second, I think it's also very important to communicate our very own scholarship. I mean, it's you, Marlene, who's famously quoted on the faculty's website with the word the humanities are the glue.
Go check that out, everyone.
Hold society together, right?
Yeah, I wrote that.
Yeah, and I firmly believe in that. And I think that, that goes for the humanities as a whole, right? But in American Studies specifically, we talk about a powerful stakeholder in the way the world functions, and that is through cultural products, but that's also through politics. That's also through science and inventions that come from the United States, right? And to understand the significance of the United States and America in this field of science communication is something that we can specifically contribute to that field. And then lastly, I also think that science communication, or thinking about science communication and communicating our very own science, but also thinking about communication and how people communicate with one another, is a certain skill set that is necessary for people in our field to then also go into the world and find jobs, right? It opens up a potential job market in the field of media, in marketing, but also in specifically science journalism as a whole, because it makes you think about a way how you can take complex pieces of information and break them down or narrativize them for a broader audience in order to make them accessible. And by that, you gain a whole new understanding yourself, so you learn better. But also, these are communicative skills that you need all the training for that we provide here. Mm-hmm. So I think science communication really is at the core of what we do here, or what I do here. I don't want to speak for everyone, but yeah. It's something that always is in the back of my mind when I plan classes, when I think about what I'm going to talk with my students about and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's also what we're doing here right now.
Of course.
Yeah.
It is. And I think that sums up the importance of science communication pretty well on a broader level. Like, as you said, it's important for the humanities as a whole and not just for us as American Studies people.
But for us specifically.
Yeah,
of course. And we're going to dive into all these like three pillars you just named in a second. But of course, we normally include kind of a pop culture example to help guide us at the beginning of every episode. But admittedly, it was a little hard for us this episode because I dare you, listener, to find any movie or book where at one point or another there isn't some form of expert knowledge conveyed. And I'm not even talking about specifically like scientific knowledge as in biology. But for example, we talked about series like Vampire Diaries and Teen Wolf and stuff like that. And at some point you will have a moment where someone in the series knows more about a curse or magic system or whatever, and will then try to convey that information in a way that the other, I don't know, vampires characters understand as well. So communicating expert knowledge on like a very baseline level is everywhere.
Yeah, it's all around us in its most simplistic form.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we did talk last season about the South Pole Station, the novel, and Don't Look Up, the movie. But we're trying very hard not to sound like broken records here.
Yeah. And this is where it gets difficult, because American studies, this is where it intervenes as a discipline, right? So this, okay, this is a drastic change of topic, but bear with me and bear with us, because I promise it makes sense. We're going to make it make sense.
Yeah. And I do get it. It's a vast issue that truly does surround us constantly, especially in an academic context, and that we need a way to engage with, which is what we're going to do now.
Yeah. So, you, Julia, you have opened these three drawers or pillars, as Mandina just said. So let's start with the first one. So you talked about like communicative structures in cultural narratives, right?
Yeah, and I think you made the or one of the main points yourself just now, because I want to stress that, or it's an ongoing debate whether fictional texts or movies, or whether we can rely on them for knowledge, right? And the real answer is we probably cannot, because I cannot double check any expert information on the curses, or I could, but you know, that would be a lot of work. So I just have to trust what is conveyed to me, or I have to be aware that that is not that this is not about factual knowledge. And my research is also like, it's not about factual knowledge, but rather, as you said, about these communicative structures and fiction as a sort of playing field for what works in communication, and how do we communicate with one another. And that can be about very real things such as climate change, medical issues, right? But it can also be about vampires and curses, and you can become an expert on vampires and curses by watching The Vampire Diaries and reading Twilight and watching Buffy, and then debating on which representation of vampirism is the most accurate, I guess, and have like debates at Comic-Con, and then you are an expert in that field and you gain that knowledge from those fictional accounts.
But in your own research, how exactly do you approach this?
I mean, there are many ways actually to do that, and I'm interested mostly in two things. So the one thing would be really this sort of playing field, right? So I read theories of how communication and science communication works or is supposed to work. And ironically, what many of these theories kind of leave out is, or what rarely they look at, is fictional text. So they point at the importance of telling a good story, and they point at the importance of evoking emotion, which literature kind of does, right? Or fictional texts kind of do, right? So I'm always like wondering why they don't turn to these examples, because also with these examples, people, authors, writers have imagined how, in which direction a sort of communicative strategy can lead, right? What could work, what could not work, what might work as an argument, what Mike in the, might work in the sense of storytelling. And of course, it's all imaginative, and it does not mean that this has to work in a certain context. But you can gain an idea, or you can supplement these theories of science communication and kind of flesh them out with the help of fictional examples. So that would be like one aspect of my research. But then the other one would be to look kind of at a meta level of what types of knowledges are conveyed in a certain piece of fiction. And that can be, we learn something about social and cultural structures, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a piece of knowledge that every piece of fiction kind of brings to the table.
Yeah.
But also, and here again, I'm interested in, because I come from the area of climate change fiction, right? I'm interested in the way climate change denialism, for instance, is portrayed. And then I'm interested in how are experts described? Like, what makes an expert in the eyes of a story, and what makes good scientific practice? Because at the end of the day, as lay people, we cannot maybe, or I cannot, validify the actual science that is talked about in climate change fiction. But I know enough, and that is what fiction can do also, to kind of have an idea about studies and verification and falsification of studies and how science technically should work, and how what scientific discourse looks like. Mm-hmm. And I find that very interesting and also very important to see how that kind of can be conveyed to a broader public.
Yeah, I think this general awareness is incredibly helpful for one, not just researchers, but everyone. But also this understanding of these mechanisms that you also talked about, and that fiction can really be a helpful tool for that, is, yeah, these communication styles and mechanisms are so essential just to express oneself in the best way possible. I mean, every day.
Yeah, and I think this beautifully leads us into the second drawer. Do we call it drawer or pillar?
I don't care.
I keep us on track. So yeah, second one.
Yeah, right. I think the second is particularly interesting in the context of our podcast right now as well. And you mentioned that in the beginning, because what else are we doing other than communicating our scientific knowledge
our
to you?
Our own research.
which Julia beautifully teased at in the beginning.
Right. And that is not all that is meant by this, even. Like, handing the mic over to our expert again. Can you tell us what first kind of comes to mind when you think about communicating your science within the field, like your own research?
Mm-hmm. I mean, science communication, the first question would be, how do we define science communication in the first place, right? So what we do here, science communication. When I teach, science communication. Mm. When I give a paper at a conference, science communication. When I talk to my neighbor about my work, science communication.
Wow.
When I give a talk somewhere to, like, at a movie theater and talk about a movie, science communication, right? Mm-hmm. And they are all different layers. When we have an exhibition of 250 years of the Declaration of Independence, science communication. So there are so many different ways in which we all communicate what we're doing and our findings and our research constantly, right? And so what I mean specifically, or I think what this podcast also does, is like having this kind of expert knowledge and bringing it to an interested broader audience, people who have not studied American studies, right? Mm-hmm. And in order to do so, there is like a constant tension between how can you simplify what you're talking about, so it is accessible to everyone. What terms can you use, etc. How much do you go into detail? And you have to kind of dial the complexity down, but you have to do so without opening up the floor for then people misunderstanding you. Because especially in the humanities, like, we're trained to talk about all the counter arguments that might occur, right? And it gets really complex. Nobody cares. But if we don't do that, and if we don't have that safety net of, yes, I've thought about that already, that's scary, but it also opens up the floor for pushback. And so we have this constant tension between what do we say to make our stuff accessible, what can we leave out. We also have a tension between the research that we still, like, that we have to do and that we have to have the time for,
yeah.
And then a completely different skill set between communicating that to our American Studies peer group audience, right, mm-hmm. at a conference, mm-hmm. as a book, as a paper, and then communicating it to a broader audience. It's the same research and it's the yeah. same information, but it's two mm-hmm. completely different styles.
Yeah.
And the question is, do we have, like, when do we find the time? Where's the focus? What do we, mm-hmm. So for me, science communication is a constant, like, tension mm-hmm. Of all things yeah. good and bad.
I mean, it's also obviously I'm going to say something very different at dinner with my parents than yes. I will on like the office hallway, mm-hmm. obviously. And there are linguistics aspects to that as well, which I think is interesting because other than one episode where we relied entirely on political quotes, for example, you don't see us citing mm-hmm. stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
And there are those smaller, like, linguistic aspects that play into that as well. Because if I were to put a quotation mm-hmm. behind every second sentence here, you would not understand me.
Yeah.
So I think that's just incredibly interesting.
Yeah. Also, I mean, as you said, it's a whole different mode from how research and doing the work actually like what that's like, and then mm-hmm. communicating it is a whole different
absolutely.
Kind of thing and a skill that needs to be developed first, right?
Yeah, and I mean, there's an ongoing debate about that, right? Because it yeah. also it makes us vulnerable mm-hmm. because we don't have the safety net of going through all the ifs and buts, and we mm-hmm. don't have the quotation to rely on with everything that we say. It's like communicating to a much broader audience, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without the safety net. And yeah. that is scary and it makes you vulnerable. And at the end of the day, if you communicate very well and you go viral on Instagram and you say something that can be held against you, right? So like there's a danger to yeah. it as well. Mm-hmm. So again, tension, right? Between staying within the safety of your own field or like branching out and doing like venturing out of the ivory tower, which yeah. I think is necessary,
yeah.
But also, yeah, scary.
Scary, yeah. But it's these communication skills that are so important. And now this refers back to your third point in the very beginning, because you also incorporate all those things in your teaching. And I know you have a specific example in mind.
Do I have two, actually.
Yeah, sorry. Two specific examples.
I mean, first of all, I think if you look at the classes I taught within the last five semesters, some form of communication has always been part of it, right? But very specifically, last semester, I taught a class where students did their own projects of science communication. Class was called The History of the U.S. Democracy. And students could make podcasts, videos, social media posts for a broader audience to themselves think about how they would communicate their very own research, right? And then this semester, I'm specifically teaching a class on science communication where we speak about all of the three. So we do some research connected to science communication, right? We've read several texts and discussed how they kind of reflect back on science communication theory, et cetera, et cetera. We also talk about how students then communicate their own research projects and how they can approach talking to a broader public, right? So approaching it again, like in the democracy seminar, from this point of view of like providing a skill set to the students, not only research based, but also in the sense of what kinds of types of skills do they need to find a job later
yeah,
on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I mean, that's very important in our field. But I wonder, having taught these classes, did you learn anything from your students about communicating research? Or don't call anyone out, but also like, oh, let's not do that. No, but did it help broaden your horizon as well, seeing people in your field who are maybe not as experienced as you, but just as eager, try to communicate their own science?
I think I learn a lot from every seminar or every class that I teach. And that is also, like, on a very basic level, science communication, right? And that can be a question that I have never been asked before in a class that I've taught 1,000 times before. And mm-hmm. that is interesting and inspiring. And I'm like, wow, I've never thought of that.
Yeah.
So to your first question, that is not seminar or class specific. Mm-hmm. In every single class, I learn something from my students. In this particular class, I think I learned, again, there's not one specific thing to point out, right? I'm always amazed by the creativity because everyone mm-hmm. brings different ideas to the table. So if someone says, oh, okay, I want to do a podcast, and they write a script or have like their first ideas, and in every single project in that class, there was at least one aspect where I was like, oh, this is really creative and really mm-hmm. cool. And I wouldn't have thought of that, right? And that's why, surprise, surprise, we need various perspectives and we need discussions and we need this exchange and talk about things because everyone brings something to the table. So that, and what I've learned as a teacher is also that it helps, that is incredibly helpful for everyone, no matter at which stage of their education or their program, to again rethink the things that they research and kind of retell that story for a different audience. And that mm-hmm. can be high school students, but that can also be your grandparents. Mm-hmm. Just to think about a topic in the way of what would I have to say if I wanted to make that accessible to whomever is so helpful in understanding or realizing if I have understood my topic myself.
Yeah.
And the sheer importance of that, I knew that somewhere in the back of my mind, but I think I've really seen that through that mm-hmm. seminar where I made students kind of do that.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think one thing you hinted at was understanding what we're being taught, what we're reading, what we're seeing. And that beautifully leads us into our next topic, because that kind of hints at media literacy, which we're going to talk about now for a little bit. And that is so essential in today's society.
Yeah. I mean, take us, for example, again, we already not so jokingly mentioned that we're currently communicating our science, but what else are we doing? Exactly, creating media, right? So this also ties into what we're doing.
Absolutely. And now this past seminar wasn't your first experience teaching media representations of any sort. Now, it is not surprising that we live in a digital age. with a never-ending flood of information reaching us through all sorts of different channels every day. And now considering that, what importance does your teaching have for you and kind of what are you trying to get out of this? We already hinted at that a little bit, but maybe mm-hmm. in terms of media literacy, can you elaborate?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are, again, those two, or maybe in this answer, like three pillars or drawers. sorry.
It's my fault. I said pillars.
So the first thing is, again, having a skill-oriented approach, right? If I want to create media, and a lot of our students go into something with media later on, if I want to create media, I need to understand media. I need to have that media literacy. I need to understand how certain images are framed, how media theory works in order to be able to then design my own media product. The same skill orientation kind of goes to future teachers, right? We also have a lot of future teachers in our seminars who have to maybe also create learning videos for hybrid or asynchronous teaching. We never know when the next pandemic hits.
You heard it here first.
We were in that uncomfortable situation where we suddenly needed to go into like or provide teaching media very quickly. And that showed me that it is necessary to provide that skill set also for future teachers, and also that rethinking what we learn at university and kind of make that available to high school students, right? That's a different layer of kind of restructuring or retelling the stories of the things that you learn at university. But that is what being a high school teacher basically is, right? So we have this very skill-oriented view. And then also we live in a world where we are influenced by, as you said, in the digital age, all types of media. We have podcasts, we have social media, we have still Hollywood film, Netflix, whatever. And a lot of these media types are highly influenced by the United States and by mm-hmm. what is produced in the United States, what is said in the United States, by the United States, by United States politics, by United States policy, right? So especially for us as scholars of American studies, it again is very important to be literate of the different media types mm-hmm. and be able to read them and understand the messages or how these how media messages are created and how especially US American media mm-hmm. images are created and how they then kind of infiltrate. And now that always sounds like a little conspiracy theory, right? But you can see that with, I don't know, the concept of neoliberalism, right? Mm-hmm. The whole self-help, self-optimization theme that has been ongoing in the United States for a very, very long time and is like still on steroids in the United States. But we can see these ideas cropping up in Germany as well and in Europe as well, right? Yeah. And if we and this kind of floods over through global media as well. And so if we understand where they come from culturally, what these images do to us, how those images function, we can kind of spread the word and make other people aware of that too. And that, again, goes for people who have podcasts and communicate what they do in this program, people who then go on to do something with media, people who go to teach in schools. We can kind of provide this sort of media literacy, not only in the sense of only media literacy, but with this US American twist and this focus mm-hmm. of this highly influential media nation.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I mean, you said it, media plays an increasingly important role in our lives, and literacy thereof actually seems to be declining.
Yeah,
yes.
So that's
unfortunately,
that
yes.
So that doesn't seem to match up, right?
Yeah, and this is why it is all the more important to engage with different types of media from different angles, right? And this goes for social media, this goes for film, but this also goes for novels and fictional texts, mm-hmm. right? Because all the things that I've said that fictional texts can teach us, right, and can do good in the world, that also means that it can be used to be propaganda and to be in support of derogatory stereotypes, right? And if you look into the history of films and literature, right, we see some texts that provide imagery that is not very progressive and great for the world, right? So the pen is mightier than the sword. So for everything that we read, that we consume, that we look at, we kind of need to have this literacy of media to understand. And we are the people who have been trained to teach that to and mm-hmm. multiply that, right? So we should
absolutely.
Do it. We should go out and spread the word.
Take that one to the bank. Now, before we go out and bring this episode to a close, mm-hmm. I just want to try to connect all that we've mm-hmm. talked about so far. Because considering our conversation at the beginning about the importance of science communication here at JGU and then connecting that to our discussion about media and literacy, mm-hmm. how does this make American studies unique as a discipline?
I'm not sure I can answer that.
You have to.
I know. I mean, and again, I've said it before. On the one hand, we have this incredible, incredible sounds very positive. We have this huge influence, right, of the United States, Hollywood movies, Netflix, politics, news, like everything that's going on in the United States, kind of comes here. Very soon, sooner than later, we'll hear about it. We see about it. And again, like Germany has this weird relationship to the United States where historically, also rightfully so, right? We're very grateful to what the United States did to Germany after the Second World War. And so we have this fascination and this historical entanglement. But that also means that becoming independent from the United States economically and military, right, is what we're all talking right now. But we are not necessarily independent from the mindset and the ideas because we still culturally consume the United States every day. And I mean, look who's talking, right? We study the United States. Yeah. So our entire job is to be immersed in the language and the culture. So we also kind of have inhaled the culture. Yeah. But I think it's important to kind of take a step back and untangle that for us. Mm-hmm. We have the skill set to do so, but it is also important to kind of point to that over and over again, that is also an issue, that when we speak about the United States, we not only speak about politics and economy and military, but we also talk about softer cultural influences. Mm-hmm. And then the last point would be that because American studies is so inherently interdisciplinary, right? It is the one discipline that kind of allows you to look at U.S. American society or U.S. American culture from so many different angles, because it does not give you the very, very singular lens of a strictly linguistic approach or a strictly literary studies approach or a strictly historical approach, right? We do all of these things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so we have kind of, we are equipped to see different angles or more different angles, plus the influence that then these different angles also have on the rest of the world.
Yeah. I think that sums it up perfectly. And I love that the interdisciplinarity mention reference. Not a single episode goes by without us kind of harping on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also,
I mean, rightfully so.
Yeah, I was obviously just gonna say that. Yeah.
I mean, we were like my science communication class yesterday. We were talking about how do we communicate American studies. We basically talked about what you do in this podcast, right?
Did you listen to it?
No. But I told them we would record today and then they will listen to this episode. Shout out to my class.
Right.
And we talked about like if we had to give a slogan to American studies, right? And the students said that American studies is so great because you can take things from various different disciplines and topics, right? And so the slogan we came up with, American studies, just do your thing.
Whoa.
You can basically do, you can follow your interests and coming from various different disciplines, right?
Yeah, that is perfect. That encapsulates it very nicely.
That's a nice ending to our topic today. But that doesn't mean we'll let you go just yet, because one last time this season, the big question, and I know you weren't so thrilled last time we asked you this, but I'm sure you've come around and you're like really happy and we've put you at ease. So we weren't too mean.
No. We're not mean. We're nice. Yes. Right. So this time, for the one big question, we would like to know if there was to be a season 3 of Make It Make Sense, and I'm not saying we're manifesting, but if there was to be a third season, what would you want one episode to be about and why?
I think that you should have a poll and should have the audience decide what topic they want.
Okay,
okay, nice so excuse for not answering yeah, that.
I know, right?
But it is good.
She went out of that one real quick.
But yeah, that's good it probably answer. Is a good suggestion anyway. So that's...
We're not going to let you off the hook. Privately, I'm going to, yeah, you know.
You but just didn't want to say that you want to be on another episode. So
we understand.
We understand
the
if
audience
you don't want to admit
will
it.
We'll make you.
Well, I mean, the thing is, the thing really is, I mean, what more could I talk about? And also, I think to have like a little engagement and ask the audience what they want to hear.
I mean, I guess we have to do it now. Yeah. That's...
Fair enough.
Go check out our Instagram and find the poll somewhere there, probably.
And with that, it's a wrap.
That's a wrap. But that's before crazy. We go, we have one tiny little thing to disclose to you guys, right? Because, you know, we have this amazing intro that plays before every episode, and we've said this on the show, I think multiple times before, that we're two research assistants, right? Especially in season one, who are embarking on this journey through, this is so cheesy, through the world of American studies with you listeners, hand in hand.
Yeah, that's wrong.
That's wrong. It was, okay, it wasn't
always wrong
during the first season.
Exactly. But
yeah.
For the entirety of this season, I have actually not been a research assistant anymore, but a doctoral researcher. But in all honesty, we loved the intro and it was really working. So we thought to set the record straight, we would just disclose that in our season finale, especially since that has already been on our Instagram and I have gotten some confused comments about that. So we're setting the record straight. Maybe if there was to be a third season, we would re-record the intro and the outro. But we did have some amazing guests and topics this season. And we will give you some more behind the scenes and some insights into our favorite moments over on our Instagram. So, you know, to check that out.
Right. At Obama Institute on Instagram. We'll see you over there. And for now, for the two of us and the three of us, it is time to say thank you to a couple people. I mean, first, thank you to the Zentrum für Audiovisuelle Produktion here at JGU. We're all waving over to,
to our producer,
to the director's booth, yeah. And their website team, who upload all of our episodes to all the various platforms that you can listen to it on. Yeah, thank you to all of our guests that we've had on the show. And thank you to everyone at the Obama Institute
exactly.
for supporting us with this project.
Very and, heartfelt yeah. thank you just for all the support and all the love that this amazing team at the Obama Institute and you, our listeners, of course, have yeah. shown us.
Thanks to everyone who tuned in again for the yes. second season. We really appreciate it.
And thank you to Julia for being our very last guest.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you for always tuning in. Stay curious and we'll see you on our Instagram,
we're just going to be really confident and say, we'll talk to you soon. And we'll definitely see you on Instagram.
All right. Bye.
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 Make It Make Sense is the official podcast of the Obama Institute for Transnational American Studies at JGU Mainz, Germany. This podcast is hosted by Marlene Winkler and Paulina Schlosser and edited by Paulina Schlosser. We're recording at the sound studios of the Zentrum für Audiovisuelle Produktion at JGU.
For more information on us, check out our website and don't forget to always keep up with us on Instagram at Obama Institute. Thank you for listening.